It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, a Wisconsin man tells us how he tried to conceal his blindness and masquerade as a sighted person.
First, we take a look at a different angle on global warming. Our next guest sees a paradox when it comes to climate change. Even as warnings get more dire and scientists try to sound the alarm, people don't take action or change their behavior, even though they may accept climate change as a reality.
Per Espen Stoknes is with us now. He's a clinical psychologist, economist, and business professor at the Norwegian Business School. He's also the author of What We Think About When We Try Not to Think About Global Warming, Toward a New Psychology of Climate Action. Per Espen, welcome to Central Time.
Great being with you, Veronica.
Well, in general, how do you think people are responding to the issues of climate change?
Well, the surveys are pretty clear. They are not getting much more concerned right now. They're drawing a big yawn, actually. And so my work starts with the mystery of the psychological climate paradox. That is that back since 1989, we've had more and more facts and more information about how serious it is, but we have a declining concern. So on average, people were more concerned about climate change in 1989 than we are today. But that's peculiar to the U.S., Canada, U.K., and Norway, among all places. So this means that understanding the human responses to climate news is clearly becoming just as important as understanding the climate change itself.
Now, we'll focus on the people who are receiving all this information in a moment. But first, what about the scientists? Are the scientists communicating as effectively as they could? They might not be the best people to communicate with the public.
You're quite right. They had this belief in just getting information out to the people, and then if the facts in their eyes become clear enough, then the people would eventually agree with the consensus of the scientists. But that's not how humans seem to perceive this thing. So we have these kind of psychological defenses that are coming up, both because of the climate issue itself and also in particular because of the way it's been framed or the way we talk about it. For instance, with climate change has been described as something far off into the future, the 2100, but, you know, who really cares that far out in time? It's also, you know, typically described as happening in the Arctic with polar bears or floods in Pakistan or cyclones in the Pacific, which is way far away from us. And finally, it's happening to somebody else, and the responsibility to do something with it, it's also way out of my scope of influence. All these things make climate seem distant to us.
Right, and you write about these things as of the five psychological barriers, you call them, to climate action, the five Ds. Let's start with distance. We hear about polar bears all the time. They're a charismatic face to have on the climate change issue, but for whatever reason, they might not be working as they once did. Why is it that the distance sets us thinking less about it?
Yeah, the distance makes it feel less personal, less relevant, and also scientists have been fond of talking about PPMs, that means parts per million of CO2, and sea level rise in inches per decade, and temperature rise and surface temperature about, you know, in a century. And all these ways of speaking puts up a long distance between what I perceive as important to me and my friends and my family and our community and the climate issue. So it makes the climate difficult to kind of get a grasp on, particularly if too much doom is used to describe the climate. So it's typically been said that if we don't change now, then we'll burn in the future. And this type of apocalyptic messaging actually backfires. We don't want to sacrifice today in order to have some salvation far into the future. And rather than becoming more engaged, the doom messaging makes us avoid the topic. We typically quickly learn to think about or filter it out.
That one is interesting, because you would expect that if we hear these dire messages, we would leap into action and change our behavior and lobby politicians for whatever we think is best. But in fact, we're not. So what is the right approach to take if it's not, you know, hey, look at these dire consequences?
Yeah, that message generates fear and guilt and maybe some anger. And all these things make us not want to engage in a sustained way. So if you want people to engage in a sustained way, you have to make it feel much nearer, more personal, more urgent, and then use more positive framing, such as this is all to do about the health of people, pollen allergies or respiratory diseases that we have today. And also we should talk about risk and insurance handling, risk management and insurance, rather than this being very uncertain and far off into the future. Because we do this all the time with defense and theft and fire. We pay for insurance in order to be ready if it did happen. And one third frame we could use for it is the opportunity frame, because as climate change comes along, it generates much more conducive conditions for distributed energy generation, better insulated homes, and much smarter resource productivity use in production and consumption. And there are huge opportunities and large sums of money to be made in climate-smart city infrastructure.
We're talking right now with Per Espen Stoknes. He's the author of What We Think About When We Try Not to Think About Global Warming, talking about the ways in which people fail to connect with the issue of global warming. And one of these is guilt, when people hear about things they shouldn't be doing, driving cars that are not fuel efficient, eating beef, for instance. What is it about using guilt that doesn't work?
Yeah, the issue is that if I know what I'm supposed to do, but then I have a lifestyle based on habits and infrastructure from the previous century, the 20th century, then we experience what we call dissonance. I know what I should do, but I do something else. And that makes us feel a bit lousy and maybe as hypocrites. And then our minds quickly come up with ways to get rid of this dissonance. And, for instance, if I doubt that message, if I doubt the experts, oh, well, you know, the climate's always changed, or I say that it hasn't really warmed since the year 1998, then it makes me feel better because I can continue living exactly as I do without any worry or feeling bad about it. So that's one of the main barriers. This dissonance creates a backlash on the science, climate science message. Therefore, it's very important to give people much more simpler way of behaving climate friendly. So if there are electric bikes that can help you get to job quicker than with a car, or if there are all the printers default print by two-sided rather than one-sided, if aeroplane tickets come with a carbon offset included, or if household appliances show the life cycle cost rather than the sales price, then it's much easier for us to do the right thing or buy the right thing. So you could say the problem is that we do mindlessly destructive choices, but the good news is that if we use nudging or behavioral economics, we can do mindless and constructive choices.
And how do we make this better? What are some of the solutions to overcoming these barriers?
Yeah. The new strategy that I'm describing builds on psychological research that we are evidence-based. We know work. And first, we need to turn these barriers upside down so we see them as success criteria. And then we need more positive strategies. We know more of these save the planet, go kill yourself messages. We have to stimulate the glow, and the flow, and the community experience and the fun. And we should act as social citizens, not as individuals. One core strategy is to use the power of social networks. What I mean by that? Well, if one house in a neighborhood gets solar panels on their roof, well, then suddenly the houses near to it have a much higher likelihood of getting solar panels as well. So solar panels is an instance of a behavior that seems contagious. And another example I like is the Green Sports Alliance, which now greens sports events such as baseball, football, soccer, or even car racing. And when people see their sports heroes, their stars, in green events and behave more green, then they want to do this so with themselves. So this has to do with what we call social norms, what we think other people would aspire to be like, are actually doing.
Per Espen, thank you so much for joining us.
Great being with you. This was most important topic.
We've been speaking with Per Espen Stoknes. He's the author of What We Think About When We Try Not to Think About Global Warming Toward a New Psychology of Climate Action.
Our next guest grew up in Wisconsin and had a long career in child protective services as an editorial cartoonist, and from his youth, he was an active athlete. But through his adult life, he struggled with declining vision. He was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa, or RP, which would eventually leave him completely sightless.
For years, he struggled to hide his condition and his failing sight from friends, coworkers, and bosses, and tried to live what he considered a normal life, even as work and daily life became more difficult, even dangerous.
Philip DiMeo joins us now. Now retired, he lives in Wauwatosa and coaches Kelly's Bleachers, the most successful co-ed softball team in Milwaukee history. He tells the story of his vision loss in his new book, Binoculars, Masquerading as a Sighted Person. Phil, welcome to the show.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Rob.
So you had vision problems as a child. They faded, they went away for a while. But in your adult life, when did you start seeing your vision decline again?
Well, actually, it was in the early 70s. I was having problems with light to dark adaption. And a couple times after I was working child protection, after going into a dark house, I came out and I stumbled and fell down the steps because the glare really got me, and I couldn't focus on where the stairs were, and I fell down a couple times down some of that stairs. And when I went into a dark building, it took a while for my eyes to adjust. So it was light to dark adaption.
So that doesn't sound too bad, but things got worse from there?
Yes, I experimented with all kinds of sunglasses, photo grays, wraparounds, you name it, but it kept getting worse, yes. And the depth perception was going too, where I couldn't even tell where one step went down and the other step started.
So as you say in your book, and even in the subtitle of the book, you were masquerading as a sighted person. Was there a moment where you said, all right, I'm having problems, I'm not going to let people know, or did it just kind of happen over time?
Well, it just kind of happened over time. Actually, after my diagnosis of RP when I was 32 years old, back in 1977, I was still in denial. Because after, you know, I thought, well, maybe it's just it was a coincidence that I have all these problems. I was night blind. I had tunnel vision. I had no depth perception. I was color blind. But yet, I thought that, you know, I had always had this, but maybe I was focusing too much on it. And then in 1978, I was diagnosed with having cataracts by an optometrist. He never mentioned RP, so I assumed that it was the cataracts as well. You know, when the cataracts ripen, I can have them removed. So then I was really in a state of denial then.
And how did it affect your life? You're having all these vision problems, trying to conceal it from people. What was life like through this stage?
Well, it was terrible because whenever I had to go to a meeting, I would stake out the room a half hour in advance, sit by the doorway, so that when I left, I wouldn't trip over anybody. And it was affecting me when I was in child protection. One time I was rescuing some children from an abusive father. I was with another lady. She took the children down the steps, and I took a box of clothes. And the father came after us, and I got in the car, and I ran the car right into a pole. And it was drivable, you know, and I made an excuse. Well, you know, I looked back to see if he was following us, but, you know, I knew that's not what it was. And then my last child abuse case came in September of 1977 when I was in a kitchen with a lady. She wanted me to take her kids and place them with her sister. And her husband came out of the bedroom, and she screamed that he had a gun, and I never saw him at all, never. And then so, you know, I got out of there. And then that was after that I decided to transfer out of child protection into a desk job.
So why do you think you were in denial? Why were you hiding this, even though it was actually causing very real problems in your work and your personal life?
During this period, my wife was a teacher, and she took off to raise our three children. She ran a daycare center here, and I was the sole support of our family, and I thought that if they found out about this, that they could terminate me, even though I had a government job, or they could transfer me to another department at a lower pay rate, and or, you know, I might be doing something else, which would be quite demeaning to me. So, you know, it was a matter of pride, and it was also a matter that I was afraid that I was going to lose my job.
We're talking to Phil DiMeo. His new book is Binoculars, Masquerading as a Sighted Person. He lives in Wauwatosa. He tells the story of his struggle with vision loss and how he tried to hide it for a while. And, Phil, let's get into when you stopped hiding it. Did you make a decision, or were you found out where you couldn't deny it publicly anymore?
Well, right before I came out of the closet with this, a supervisor saw me bump into some chairs, and I was called in. He was a section. He demanded to know what was wrong with my vision. Of course, I didn't tell him. And then eventually he was replaced. They had a new regime in here. And the new directress, I decided to tell her because I was having trouble. Not only I couldn't drive, but I was also I had trouble with my paperwork. We were using computer forms that were colorized, and I couldn't actually fill them out. So I went to the new directress, and I told her that I could no longer do the job, and I told her what I had. She said she was familiar with RP. She said, if it's okay with you, I'd like to send you to MATC, the Special Needs Department, you know, so I would learn mobility training using a white cane, which I hated. I would learn Braille, which I used a little bit, but I don't use anymore. And also I would learn computers. And so I agreed to do that, and that's, you know, that basically that was a big you know, a big weight lifted from me. But that's what happened.
Yeah. So what's changed now that you're checking out these different alternatives? You're acknowledging the problem. Did your life get better or worse?
Well, it got better because then you know they made accommodations for me while at work. So you know I went to I had an office job. Although there was one section had. A couple years later that felt that I shouldn't be working there because I couldn't see and I couldn't read the paperwork. But she eventually left and I stayed. But, yeah, so anyway, I felt a big weight had been lifted. And then I went through the training, although I never used the cane at all, and I never really used Braille. But I went through the training. In fact, the first time they took me over to the Vision Forward and I got my cane, I thought to myself, what am I doing here, you know? So I used a cane at work. I was ordered to it because I bumped into a lady, a secretary, and I spilled coffee all over her. So I was ordered to use the cane at work. But after work, I put the cane away, and I never used it at all.
What does the world look like to you now? How much vision have you lost at this point?
I have no vision at all. I've had no vision for about 20 years. What I see now are sparklers, blotches, lights blinking on and off. Silver and black sparklers. I was told by an ophthalmologist that I'm hallucinating, not in the normal sense, but my retina is sending it's sending signals to the optic nerve, to the brain, but because my retina is shutting off, this is what I'm seeing. I see nothing.
Now, you're retired now, you mentioned. You are known as a success story in the world of softball. You're a softball coach with a team with a phenomenal record, I understand, at Kelly's Bleachers in the Milwaukee area. How do you coach, someone might ask, if you can't really see much of anything?
Well, as I said, I can listen. I'm tuned in to what's going on. And I make sure that all the players that are like, you know, last night I was worried that, some of the players were showing up late. I make out the lineup. I tell them exactly where I want them to play, and I prepare them before we even have our games, during the week. And I can tell by listening. For example, if a ball is hit to the shortstop or the third base, I can tell. And if the runner is running, I can tell when the ball hits the first baseman's glove if the runner is out or safe. And I can also tell when it's a pop up, and just by listening, I've become pretty good at that. And after the games, I will even tell everybody what they did. And praise them for what they did.
And you're off to a good start this year, I understand, on the team?
Yeah, we're 3-0. As of now, I've got 362 wins, 38 losses, 14 championship titles, and we hold the record from 1999 to the middle of 2004. We won 68 games in a row.
Now, as we wrap up, Phil, I mean, your story is unique, but a lot of people have probably been through something similar. Maybe they're denying a hearing loss later in life, or changes in mobility, or maybe the limits a heart condition might put on them. If there's somebody out there listening and they're in that boat, they're not sharing what's going on, what is your advice to them?
Well, there are a lot of places that can help them. As for my thing, they have Vision Forward, which is a Badger home. I would suggest that they get assistance or whatever it is. I was basically too proud to accept assistance at that time. But eventually, I did, and it's helped me a lot. I went full circle when I went to get my first guide dog, LaDonna, in 2004. And that, and now I have my second guide, Tessie. We had to put LaDonna down November 16th. And it's amazing what these dogs can do. And there's a lot of help out there. They should find out, what's available for them, and that's what I suggest. And the people that are involved in helping, whether it's, whether it's a hearing thing or you have an addictive or anything else, they're very, very good. And I would suggest people seek help.
Phil, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Rob.
That was Philip DiMeo of Wauwatosa. We've been talking about his new book just out. It's called Binoculars, Masquerading as a Sighted Person. In light of several recent high-profile police-involved shootings, there's a growing conversation about the role of police in the United States and how they do their jobs. Some police leaders are saying that's manifesting itself in anti-police sentiment that could make the job more difficult and more dangerous.
Speaking yesterday at a press conference to announce the death of a police officer, New York City Police Commissioner Bill Bratton said you'd almost have to go back to the late 60s, to early 70s, to see a time when there was so much anti-police sentiment in the country. As the national conversation about police relations with minority communities continues, how will police on the job be affected in terms of safety and morale?
Here with us now to discuss attitudes toward police in the U.S. today is Jim Palmer. He's the executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. Jim, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Rob.
So let's start with that quote from Commissioner Bratton in New York City that you'd have to go back to the late 60s, early 70s to see so much anti-police sentiment in the country as we do today. Do you think he's right to make that comparison of today's feelings toward the police to those of a very turbulent era?
Well, I'm not so sure. I mean, certainly there are a plethora of challenges confronting our society, certainly as it relates to racial disparities, and there have been a number of high-profile law enforcement controversies that have been in the media, and that really has developed into a significant theme. But I can tell you that as I talk with officers around Wisconsin, it really is a mixed bag. I mean, there are some officers who see the media coverage and think that their profession is under attack. And others are in Madison in particular are reporting that, they're noticing an increase in people coming up to them on the street while they're working and thanking them for the jobs that they do. To test this question somewhat, we commissioned a statewide poll with the St. Norbert College Strategic Research Institute in early March. And we've been conducting this poll for 3 years in which we asked the public a wide variety of law enforcement issues. And the one question we've asked that's carried over from year to year is how people feel about law enforcement and what is that approval rating. And we were actually surprised, pleasantly surprised, to find out that the approval rating of law enforcement officers in Wisconsin this year is as high as it's ever been in the 3 years we've been conducting the poll.
Do you have a sense, I mean, that's surprising you say, do you have a sense why that is, why that rating has improved over the time of that survey?
Well, I think, people in Wisconsin recognize that we are blessed with some of the very best law enforcement officers in the entire country. We have officers that are extraordinarily well-trained on a wide variety of issues that I don't think are trained to the same extent in other states. For example, racial and cultural sensitivity training is more common. Body cameras have become more common in Wisconsin, and that's something that's going to continue to occur. And we also have the benefit of a new state law that mandates an independent and transparent investigation of any officer-involved shooting. We're the first such state to have a law like that, and I think, we're still the only state that has such a law. So I think we've tried, in Wisconsin, the law enforcement community has tried to take a broader and longer view approach, and I think that's benefited our officers in terms of how the public feels about them.
And you mentioned earlier some of what you've heard from officers here in the state, for better or worse. Are officers connecting, the media coverage of police-involved shootings, of protests that follow them? Are they watching that? Are they watching that to see what the rhetoric is like, what the public response is like?
Oh, they most certainly are. And it's very true that, there are quite a few that do express to me some frustration. And, when you see an officer like the one in New York that was just killed, and clearly that officer was targeted, that's something that's on the minds of many law enforcement officers, not only the officers themselves, but their families who have to, say goodbye to them, each and every day as they report to duty, hoping that they'll return.
And then we saw charges filed in a case in Baltimore. There's questions here in Madison, still waiting to see if a district attorney will file charges against a Madison officer involved in a shooting. Are officers concerned about that? Do they think that Are they worried that there will be too much crackdown on their behavior if there are indictments like this?
No, I don't believe that's the case. I mean, law enforcement officers go into the profession knowing that, you know, their jobs carry a heightened level of public scrutiny. Certainly, the scrutiny as of late has been extraordinary, and I know that's a concern for some officers. I don't think that it is going to change their behavior necessarily. I think it will, you know, encourage the law enforcement community to explore ways it can improve its relationship with the community, how it can improve, communicating on complicated and sensitive issues like use of lethal force and use of force generally. And certainly, I think the law enforcement community and the profession will benefit as a result of that. But I think in Wisconsin, we're ahead of the curve in terms of taking those measures and taking those steps when compared to other states.
Talking to Jim Palmer with the Wisconsin Professional Police Association about public attitudes toward police officers in light of police-involved shootings, protests around the country over the last year. You say largely a positive message, it sounds like, Jim, from police officers. Do you hear any cases of people saying, you know, because of the increased scrutiny, the rhetoric, people thinking about maybe going into other lines of work or retiring from the job?
I haven't heard that from any active law enforcement officers. I have heard from several retired officers who have commented to me that they are in many ways glad that they're no longer in the profession because they feel that there is some sense that the scrutiny is unfair and is too great. But I haven't heard that from any active officers. I am confident are going to continue to do their jobs with the utmost professionalism, and that's what we expect from them here in Wisconsin. We are concerned about, maybe the long-term implications of some of this media coverage and how that might affect people who are considering whether to enter the profession, whether it's in Wisconsin or another state. So that is a concern that we have, down the road.
And do you have thoughts or do you hear thoughts from police officers about how the media in particular is treating these issues, covering it, whether we're talking print, TV, radio, you name it?
I think it's fair to say that I've heard from quite a few law enforcement officers around the state that think the media coverage has been unfair and it's been, very much preoccupied with every single, use of force incident. Anytime a law enforcement officer has to take that unfortunate step to use force in the line of duty, it is a front page story. Whereas, when we have an officer shot and killed in the line of duty, or there was one that was, I believe, yesterday in Pennsylvania that was struck by a drunk driver during a motor vehicle stop. That's just something that we don't read with the same frequency and with the same prominence.
Now, apart from these life or death situations, there's a lot more in police work. Are law enforcement agencies doing enough to communicate the breadth of the work to the public, apart from the ones that end up in the news?
Well, I don't think they are. And I've said before, and I think that there's something that the law enforcement community nationally is going to really have to, find out a better way to engage the public, not only on use of force issues, although that's a tremendously critical one, but on, just generally on the different jobs that they do. I mean, the problem is you have men and women in law enforcement who don't go into this profession and don't do their jobs looking for any praise. You know, every year our organization gives out service awards for officers who have gone above and beyond the call of duty. And we have a very nice banquet for them. Just had it here a few weekends ago at the Kalahari Resort in Wisconsin Dells. And it's rare that an officer wants to say a few words after getting this award. Or if they do, the most common response they have, a reaction they have, is that, I was just doing my job. And so you really have a modest class of men and women. And that's something that I find so very honorable about them. But I think law enforcement as a profession and as a community is going to have to do a better job in communicating on a wide variety of issues and the services they provide, in particular when it comes to use of force. I know we've received quite a few emails from some very well-meaning people who I think they express a general support for law enforcement, but they ask questions like, why don't the law enforcement officers use nets? And why don't the police officers, use tranquilizer darts? And, these are questions from, again, well-meaning people. And so I think there is an information gap, in terms of people's understanding of how you know, that a law enforcement officer makes the decision to use force and what their protocols are. But the law enforcement community bears some responsibility for that, and that's something that's going to have to improve.
A related issue is transparency. You mentioned body cameras earlier as something that's being explored, being used more and more around the country. There have been debates, confrontations sometimes over bystanders filming or videotaping, I should say, police activity with cell phones and things like that. Is there a case to be made that more transparency in police encounters of any sort helps the public and might help the police officers know that their side is out there, too?
I think so, and that's why we support body cameras. In fact, it was another question that we asked about in our annual poll recently. And, the reason you do a poll is to kind of test some assumptions, and we want to make sure that we're as an organization, being responsive to where the public is and how they feel about law enforcement issues. And we asked about body cameras. We assumed that the support would be significant. We had not seen a poll that actually posed that question. And we were not surprised that 82% of the respondents indicated the support for the proliferation of body cameras, and 68% said that they would support an increase in their local law enforcement agency's budget to pay for them. So I think that's those are very strong indicators that people believe in that in those tools, and that they will add accountability. And we would agree that this emerging technology does have the potential to protect not only the general public, but law enforcement officers as well.
We're talking right now with Jim Palmer of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association about the country's attitudes toward police officers following a number of high-profile officer-involved shootings and what some police leaders are calling an anti-police sentiment in some places.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you see a growing sense of distrust towards law enforcement in your community or around the nation? Do you have questions about the way police officers do their jobs? And what do you think can be done to improve the relationship between police and civilians? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking right now with Jim Palmer of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association about public attitudes toward the police in the United States. New York City's police commissioner says we haven't seen anti-police sentiment like this since the late 60s to the early 70s. What do you think?
Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you see a backlash against law enforcement in your community? Would you welcome more scrutiny of officers, or should they be left to do their jobs? What would need to be done to shore up the relationship between law enforcement and its critics? And are you in law enforcement? What do things look like from your line of work? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to Eric with us on the line in Endeavor. Eric, hi.
Hello, I'm an unarmed white male in the United States, and I think that they've done it to themselves. As far as every single cop that gets involved in a situation makes the front page, but when one gets hurt, it doesn't. There's probably one in 10,000 times it makes the front page. And just a couple small more points. Scrutiny, good. Public servants, they are public servants, not kings. They're public servants. Roofing is 8 times more dangerous than being a public, than being a police officer, according to insurance companies.
Eric, I'll jump in and get a response from our guest. Thanks for calling in. So he says police, he started by saying police are bringing it on themselves if there's negative reaction to officers. Jim?
Well, police officers don't go around in most cities. They don't go around looking for things to do. They're honestly, the nature of the job today is responding to one call to another. And that makes up a shift. So, law enforcement officers don't go around looking for, situations as much as they would like to, be more proactive in that regard. I mean, the job, it really is, in many ways, running from one call to the next. And so I think that's a little bit of an unfair characterization. And he is correct that law enforcement officers are public servants. And I think that, I think most people believe, and certainly that's reinforced by our poll, that they're public servants for whom the people have great respect, because I believe law enforcement officers, they take an oath to put the safety of their neighbors above their own. And as difficult and challenging and dangerous apparently as roofing may be, I'm not sure that that's true in other occupations.
Back to our callers now. We've got John on the line in Wisconsin Dells. John, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I would like to comment in regards to the respect. I feel respect is a dying attribute that with generations coming up, they're lacking this with the parents, with just people in general. Police officers are here to serve and protect. They can't choose situations. They have to take the situation. And most likely, these situations have these people that they don't respect other people. In the situation with in Ferguson, where we had Michael Brown allegedly reaching into the police car, that is just grounds their lack of respect. When someone does this, it's pretty much open field day on that person. You have crossed a line that you have now disrespected that person, that police officer that is. He sent there to protect people.
John, thanks for the call. So, first of all, Jim, do police officers see, when you talk to them, a lack of respect, in particular from the younger generations?
I think there may be something to that. I mean, certainly, just looking at some numbers, over the last 5 years, we have seen a pretty significant increase in assaults on law enforcement officers in the line of duty. Officers, because of their workforce, they tend to have to go into situations, at least initially, without the benefit of backup. And so I think you do have individuals that are more brazen, but I don't think that these situations occur necessarily out of a lack of respect. I think you have people that are more brazen, and that certainly contributed to it. But when an officer is faced with a deadly threat, I mean, they have to act accordingly. And no law enforcement officer looks to forward or plans on using force in the line of duty. They do have that significant training, of course. And we hold them to a very high standard. And as we should. I think there probably is something to that about the lack of respect, but I don't know that if it's just applied to law enforcement officers, but certainly we have criminals across the country that are a lot more brazen. And just, again, mentioning or referring back to the New York officer, but, you know, in some cases law enforcement officers are being targeted. And so that's a very real concern.
John, suggesting that treating an officer with a lack of respect creates an open field for a police response using violence, it sounded like. Do you think that's right as far as how police officers behave or should behave?
No, absolutely not. Law enforcement officers have to make use of force decisions based upon the circumstances. And when it comes to the use of lethal force, they have to it has to be a deadly threat that they're confronted with. And those decisions are scrutinized extraordinarily heavily, as they should. And so law enforcement officers take those actions and make those split-second life and death decisions, as we expect them to. But they do it on the basis of the circumstances and the conduct of an individual, and respect isn't a motivating factor.
Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
That was Jim Palmer, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. Joined us to talk about our country's attitudes toward police officers in the light of recent high-profile shootings and how law enforcement and its critics can maybe work out their issues.